welcome to the Upwards Podcast. I'm Dan, one of your hosts, and today I'm getting to talk to my friend, John Wilsey, a professor at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, about his new book, Religious Freedom, A Conservative Primer. And this is a wide-ranging conversation, but we really get into how the idea of conservatism is much bigger and deeper than the politics that we talk about often when we talk about conservatism. We get into ideas or concepts like the conservative imagination and the conservative view on history. And we ultimately talk about some of the key figures in the history of conservatism and end talking about the idea of religious freedom and how that fits in to both a Christian and a conservative view of the world. Excited to share this conversation with John Wilsey. Welcome to the Upwards Podcast, where we discuss the intersection of Christian faith in the academy, church, and marketplace to illuminate the good work happening with individuals, institutions, and in our communities. I'm Dan, one of your hosts, and I'm here today with John Wilsey, a historian and author of the recent book, Religious Freedom, A Conservative Primer. Hi, John.
Dan, how are you?
I'm doing well, and I'm really looking forward to the conversation about this book. Before we get into that, I'll give just a little formal intro of John. John Wilsey is professor of church history and philosophy and chair of the Department of Church History and Historical Theology at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And he's the author of many books, and the most recent one being the one I mentioned, Religious Freedom, with Erdmans, and it just came out in recent weeks.
Yeah.
So, John, I was happy to read this book before it came out. I thought it was a really interesting take on both sort of what is at the heart of conservatism as a way of seeing the world and on the topic of religious freedom, which is in the title. So I thought we could start by me asking you, one of the unique things I think about the book is that you're gearing it toward young Americans, as you say. And I wondered why. What was the thinking behind that? And how did that perspective come about to write the book to younger Americans?
Well, that's great, Dan. And first of all, just thank you very much for having me on the podcast. It's an honor to be with you. And I really appreciate the invitation. Yeah, there are a few reasons why I had young people in mind for this book. First and foremost is that my children are, you know, they're Gen Z, and they're my oldest is a sophomore in college, and my youngest is a sophomore in high school. So I really had have them in mind as I wrote the book. My oldest daughter read all my chapters and my drafts when I was writing them, giving me pointers, and those were all. It was all really great to kind of, you know, have her as a partner. She's my kids have always been real little when I was writing my other books, and so it was a lot of fun to get her feedback on this one. Another reason is because early in the project, it sort of dawned on me that my own students, the people, the students that I teach, they don't remember September 11th. You know, and they don't remember, to say nothing of Reagan or the Reagan Revolution. They don't remember Newt Gingrich, you know, the Republican Revolution, the contract with America and all that stuff. And as I thought about that, they don't really have the same heroes that I had when I was their age, of course. My heroes were, I loved Reagan. I loved Thatcher. I loved John Paul II. We were just talking a second ago. I loved Brian Mulroney in Canada. I had conservative heroes when I was in my teens and 20s. And early in the project, I thought, who is worthy of emulation and looking up to as a conservative leader in America today? And just trying to think about who they have to really look up to. And there aren't very many people. There's some thought leaders, and there's some maybe some journalists and people like that. But in terms of political figures in the world, there aren't very many. So I wanted to give young people a vision for what true conservatism can look like. I say in the book that I don't think it's possible to be a true conservative. I think conservatism is an aspiration to aim for. I aspire to be a consistent and a true conservative, but I don't think that I will ever attain that in my life, because the conservative aspiration, I think, is one to align your life and your worldview with the transcendentals, the true, the good, and the beautiful. Hmm.
You're sitting there at Southern Seminary, obviously deeply committed to your Christian faith. How did that intersect with thinking about writing this book? Sort of how does your faith, how does your Christian commitments inform why you wanted to write a book about conservatism now?
Yeah, I'll just say as a Christian and as a history teacher, I tell my students a lot that, well, let me just back up. When I teach my history classes at Southern, the first thing I say to them on the first day of class is, how many of you don't like history? And most of the students are a little shy. They don't want to on the first day out themselves.
Right.
But I used to teach in a maximum security prison. I used to teach history in a maximum security prison for 6 years, and they were not shy. So whenever I asked that question, I would have probably a third of the class raise their hand and asking questions about why. They always had the same kind of answers, you know, that, well, they had a bad teacher, or they just think it's boring, or they didn't do well in their classes, or they didn't see it was relevant, you know, on and on. And what I usually tell students is that if you're a Christian, it's not really open to you to not like history, because our whole faith is historical. And as a historical faith, that means that we're interested in tradition and the role of tradition, and we revere tradition in some way. Mm. And that is a conservative impulse. So that's where I see the real link between Christianity as a faith, as a walk with God, our creator, and as what the conservative impulse is to revere and pass down steward tradition.
Do you see younger Americans having a harder time making that connection? Or is that something every generation of Americans is having to sort of rediscover?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that young people, just in general, I'm not a young person, so I can't speak for young people. But I used to be a young person. I remember what it was like to be a young person. And I think in general, young people don't think about receiving tradition or passing it down. I think that's something that when you get older, you start to think about that more. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm in my 50s. And when I crossed over into my 50s, maybe a little bit earlier, I did start to think about those things more. And so as an older person, you know, someone that's, you know, reached beyond the midpoint probably of my life, I do think about that more. And so I think it's sort of a duty of mine as an older person and as a father to at least expose young people to that concept, to prepare them to at least think about it. I don't think that young people, I don't really expect young people to think about tradition that way yet when they're in their 20s, but certainly maybe prepare them for it for later in life, especially when they have children of their own.
Yeah. You mentioned September 11th and that, so I'm a millennial and that I was in middle school when that happened, and it really did prompt, obviously I love history. I got a PhD in history later, so I'm not the norm, but I remember that was one of the events that really made me ask some historical questions, among other types of questions, about how we got to this point in 2001. Right. Right. And so that did prompt a sort of historical imagination, or at least a historical curiosity, that I ended up, you know, following more than most into my adulthood. Do you get a sense, I think maybe the answer for like a Gen Z type historical event might be COVID or something. I'm not exactly sure what the historical resonance, but do you get a sense at all? Is there, the students you teach, is there a moment in the last decade or a sort of theme or something about how they do think about the past? Mm. Or what in their experience would get them to be interested in the past? I guess is another way of saying it.
Yeah. I think probably COVID is the closest thing because it was the thing that was most all-consuming for our lives, you know, during that year or 2 years of going through that. I would have to say that would be it. But beyond that, I'm just sort of just speculating because students don't really tell me, you know, this is something like they don't really talk about, like, well, where were you when you found out the school was going to go fully online and things like that. I think that, you know, for September 11th, I remember the Challenger disaster when I was in 10th grade when that happened. Maybe most famous for our parents and grandparents would have been the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
those are dramatic events that happen like on one time in one day. And COVID was this, you remember, I mean, it was this sort of death by a thousand cuts type thing.
Right.
So I don't know if there is a parallel event for them. I kind of hope for their sake that there isn't one, you know, they're pretty traumatic. They're pretty awful.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's interesting. You know, it is, but they are, those kind of moments are helpful to kind of place us and define our times for our generation as we're coming through.
Yeah. And I just think here at Upper House, we have a multi-generational team. And actually, as you were listing those historical events, I can recall a conversation with people on our staff about the Kennedy assassination, about the Challenger explosion, about September 11th. So there's also some real wisdom to be gained by speaking across generations like you are in the book, recognizing that there is a lot to learn from those older from us.
Yeah.
That takes us to, you mentioned one of the key terms in your book, aspirational conservatism. Mm-hmm. So unpack that a little more. What do you mean by aspirational conservatism? And maybe how does it not reflect what many people might associate with, if you just said, I'm a conservative, or what conservatism means in our culture right now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what it means now is that you voted for Trump, that you're a MAGA person. And, you know, and if it's any deeper than that, it sort of marks you as being, you know, kind of on one side of the fence on very specific issues,
right,
whether it be, you know, social issues or economic or foreign policy, things like that. Mm-hmm. In short, I think that most people think of a conservative in specifically political terms.
Right.
But following traditionalist conservatives like Russell Kirk, like Richard Weaver, like Peter Viereck, who I talk about in the book, they all agreed that conservatism is a disposition. And they get that, I think, from Edmund Burke in the late 18th century. And by disposition, they meant something that was that began with a view of reality, a view of the world, a view of change and our position in time. So a pre-political foundation for an entire way of looking at the world. And so I took their dispositional conservatism and I adapted the term a little bit to aspirational, to reflect a more American kind of a sense of conservatism. Because Americans have historically been people that have looked to the future, even as they are being informed by their history and informed by their traditions. So I think conservatives often are looked at by both people on the left and by, you know, some people who are self-identify as conservatives, that they don't like change, that they resist change. You know, there's that famous statement by William F. Buckley, that, you know, we stand athwart history and yell stop. And that's a quotable, charming phrase, but I don't even think Buckley really believed that. Hmm. Conservatives are realists, and all realists know that change is inevitable. You can look in the mirror and see change. I mean, change is everywhere. So conservatives, it's not that conservatives resist change or hate change. Conservatives seek to manage change. Through deliberation, through procedure, through just law and just order, because conservatives believe that human beings are flawed and they sometimes, you know, reach for power and they're sinful and so forth. And Americans have always been optimistic about the future. They've aspired to something all the way back to our founding documents. Those early aspirations in the founding documents are laid out in the Declaration of Independence. They're laid out in the preamble to the Constitution. Americans have always been an aspirational people, reaching forward, looking ahead, optimistic, able to laugh at themselves. Sometimes that optimism has gotten them into trouble. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, Americans are aspirational, and conservatism is also aspirational. Conservatism is humanistic in the sense that true conservatism is after the flourishment of humanity, both the individual and the community. And so that's what I'm trying to get across in the book, that conservatives aren't, they're not to be self-centered. They're not to be, you know, just looking out for their own interests and to heck with everybody else. Mm. Conservatives are interested in civilization and all of civilization and for human benefit. And that's why I use that term.
Yeah. I wonder if for some of our listeners who aren't as familiar with the way some of these terms are used, particularly among scholars and others who write about it, talk to us about the relationship between what you're calling aspirational conservatism and what we might call classic liberalism. And those terms in our politics, you know, liberals on one side, conservatives on the other, but there also seems to be an overlap between some of the values that an aspirational conservative would have, in your view, and some of the, at least some of the concerns that a classic liberal would have about, even about something like religious freedom, which is what your book's title is. How do you see the relationship between those two sort of traditions or bodies of thought?
When you talk about classical liberalism, are you just mean like Lockean?
Right. So, sort of a tradition of coming out of the Enlightenment, I guess you could say, is where classical liberalism comes from. There is, of course, like an economic component to classical liberalism, but there's a deeper sense of the individual, the rights of the individual, mm-hmm. the limited powers that any type of overarching institution should have on the individual.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah. Good. I think there's a lot of overlap. Because, and the reason why is because the American order has been informed so deeply by Lockean liberalism.
Right.
So there's going to be a great deal of overlap. But there are some distinctions too. I'm not a libertarian. Hmm. And a libertarian perspective, there's sort of a rightist and a leftist libertarian perspective on life. But I think libertarians would generally not call themselves conservatives. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons why is because libertarians stress the individual as the basic unit of society. And as a sort of a traditionalist conservative in the school of a Russell Kirk or a Edmund Burke, I think the unit of society, basic unit of society, would be the family. Mm. Because in the family, this is something that Richard Weaver talks about. The family is where you learn your place in a society for the first time. I was the youngest brother. I had an older brother, and it didn't take long for me to learn that, you know, where things stood, you know, where I was on the pecking order. And that was just between us, between the kids. But I also knew early on that, you know, I don't get to correct my parents when I think they've done something wrong. But they get to correct me because I'm the child. Mm. So you learn early on a hierarchical order. You learn that you have to follow the rules. You don't get to make the rules. In other words, in the family, you're in your childhood, you're prepared to live as a responsible citizen. You learn citizenship. You have to learn selflessness when you're in a family. And if the individual is the basic unit of society, well, how do you learn any of those things? Well, you can't. You can't learn those things in isolation. On the other hand, the stress, the emphasis on individual rights, the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, for example, the rights of the individual citizen balanced with the rights of the society or the community, those are also conservative concerns, and we do have that in common with our libertarian brethren. Mm. We also have in common a desire to limit government and limit the scope of government, the power of government, because government tends to fill every vacuum left behind by citizens who are no longer interested in dealing with a particular problem in a community. So as soon as citizens in a local community are no longer willing to deal with a particular problem, government is more than happy to step in and deal with it. Tocqueville writes about that impulse in a democracy, that voluntary societies in local communities, generally in America, take care of local problems. But when citizens turn inward and they turn into their selfish interests, then government steps in, and that's how government grows. And that's how majoritarian tyranny ends up sort of sucking all the oxygen out of the room. So it's something in particular that Americans must guard against. That's a little bit of a long answer to the question, but I hope that helps.
Yeah, that does. You've mentioned a few people here that are really important to the conservative intellectual tradition: Edmund Burke, Russell Kirk, Tocqueville, Peter Viereck. Why don't you help us get acquainted with a few of them? Let's start with Burke. I think for anyone who reads a book on the history of conservative thought, Edmund Burke's probably the person that's mentioned as sort of the originator in some sense of the tradition. Mm. Give us a thumbnail sketch of Edmund Burke. Who was he? When did he live? Why do we always reference him when we talk about the origins of conservative thought?
Yeah, Edmund Burke was an Irishman. He served as a member of Parliament in the late 18th century, and he's best known for his book, Reflections on the Revolution in France, that he wrote in 1790. And it's a book form. It was actually a letter that he wrote, an extended letter that he wrote, where he addressed his concerns about the revolution in France. And it was it's a large critique of a Rousseauian social contract philosophy. So one of the most famous things that he did in that work was to define society contrasted with a Rousseauian understanding of the social contract. For Rousseau, society was a contract between that involved the living. But Burke famously says in Reflections on the Revolution in France, he says, society is indeed a contract. It's a contract between the living, the dead, and the yet to be born. So he sees society as an organic whole. The dead, they're the ones that we received tradition from. They are the ones that we received our stewardship from. And the dead still speak to us in important ways, even though they're not walking around among us. And then we're stewarding tradition and preparing it for a generation that's yet to come. To see society in terms of the living only is the height of a communal selfishness. And that was one of the fatal problems of Rousseau's political philosophy. So that's Burke in a nutshell.
Yeah. And even that formulation of a society has sort of an obligation to the dead, the living, and the yet to be born. I think for a lot of Americans, you mentioned before the sort of forward-looking, future-looking sense. I think a lot of Americans, whether they're conservative or not, feel some obligation to the yet to be born, at least some of them. You know, we talk a lot about the environment and other things, and we talk about, will our kids, and that's a traditional American view, you know, you always want your kids to have a better life than you did.
Yeah.
I think the obligation to the dead is a less intuitive one to many Americans. Maybe part of that is a pretty strong sense of progress, or at least assumption of progress, that in some ways we know better than our ancestors. And so, you know, we actually have a duty to sort of surpass them or something.
Yeah.
And maybe for some, a quite critical view of American history that sees a lot of American history as a lot of mistakes or sins that need to be redeemed in the future or in the present. How much of this attentiveness to the past, particularly to the dead, to the people that came before us, I know Burke had that. Talk about a bit more. How does that inform what you call the conservative imagination or the aspirational conservatism that you're talking about?
Yeah. I have a whole chapter on conservatism and history where I talk about this as well. And in that chapter, I try to advocate for a method of history that's informed by virtue, that doing history is actually an ethical practice. And what I mean by that, in short, in a nutshell, is that everything that we are, everything that we believe, our personalities, our fundamental values and the way we see the world, we didn't just get this from nowhere. We received these things from people who have gone before us, many of whom are dead. We remember the dead at various points on the calendar. We're about to have Memorial Day in a few weeks. What do we do at Memorial Day? Well, we memorialize those who died in the wars that, were fought on our behalf. That's just one aspect. And sort of to quote a biblical allusion from Hebrews 11, the dead still speak in important ways. So that means that we have a duty to the dead, a duty to be charitable to them. That doesn't mean that we excuse their sins. To be charitable to the dead is not a way to ignore or whitewash their sins. It is to tell the truth about them. The way that we love the dead is to tell the truth about them. So I use that term not in a sentimental sense, but in a way that we're going to treat them with justice. So we tell the truth about them. Good things, bad things, and anything in between that's relevant. When we tell the truth about the dead, it informs us. It informs our own way of life. And there's a couple of people that I've really enjoyed reading on this subject. Beth Barton Schweiger, is one. And John Lewis Gaddis is another one. In John Lewis Gaddis's book, The Landscape of History, he says that history is like looking at a map, or it's like standing on top of a mountain and looking out over the view. You have a particular perspective on the past and on the people of the past who are no longer living. And your perspective is a privileged perspective. They didn't have the perspective that you have now. And so Beth Schweiger says, well, that means we have a little bit of power over the dead. We have quite a bit of power over the dead. And how are we going to use that power? We can use that power either for self-aggrandizement, or we can use that power for self-examination. So Beth Schweiger talks about how the work of history actually changes the historian. It changes me. When I read history, it changes me. That's aspirational conservatism. I aspire to be a better man than I am, a more virtuous man, a more faithful man, a better man in terms of how I treat others, treat my neighbor, a more faithful believer, more faithful to my wife and my children. History teaches me that because I value history, I value the past, I value tradition. These are all things, again, that comport with what conservatism holds up.
The podcast notes for today's conversation include a link to view this episode on YouTube. Remember to follow or subscribe to stay updated with our latest episodes in your podcast app.
This is sort of off script, but have you read the novel The Ender's Game?
No.
Read it? Okay, so it's a sci-fi novel from the 80s written by Orson Scott Card, who's actually known as a conservative science fiction writer. Anyway, I will not go into the plot for the audience, but there is a role that Ender, the main character, plays, and it's called Speaker for the Dead. That's actually what he's known as. And he's speaking for a race of aliens that were killed in a conflict that is at the center of the story. But it just made me think that actually the way you're talking about the conservative imagination in relationship to the dead is probably what informed the way Orson Scott Card sort of created this fictional role in his novel as well. It sort of comes out of a conservative imagination. And that's one of the things I want to talk about next here is the way that when we think of conservatism, even in the way you're talking about, John, we're thinking of something really, as you said, pre-political, something that is sort of informs art and sort of philosophy and the way you think about nature and these things that often aren't talked about when we talk about conservatism.
Right.
I think one of the people at the core of sort of expanding this tradition in that, maybe not expanding, but at least articulating it for Americans, was Russell Kirk, who I know you spent some time at the Russell Kirk Center that sort of carries on his legacy. So that probably informed some of why you talk about him in the book. But talk to us about Russell Kirk. Give us a thumbnail of who he was, when he lived, and why he's another person when you go into this history, sort of you have to mention him as a pivotal figure as well.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. Russell Kirk was born in 1918 and he died in 1994. Spent his writing career, at what he called his ancestral home, Piety Hill, he called it, in Macosta, Michigan, the little town of Macosta, Michigan, which has a population today of just over 400 people. He did his writing in a converted toy factory. So the library that he worked in, his own library and his own office and everything, was in a converted toy factory. And that toy factory is just down there, just a short walk down a country lane from his house. And Russell Kirk was a great personality, as were all these people. All these people have great personalities. And Russell Kirk is no exception. He was a famous night owl, for example. And he had a tradition of taking long walks in the middle of the night. And I am a night owl. So I did spend a few weeks, about a month in Macosta at the Kirk Center. And when I wrote chapter one, I wrote chapter one while I was spending those weeks at the Kirk Center. And I adopted that as my own habit, just in the spirit of being in Macosta. So I would take walks at 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning, and they were fun. They were interesting. I would work in the Kirk Library at, wee hours of the night to 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning in the spirit of Russell Kirk. And It was a fun time because, you know, Russell Kirk was a great conservative writer and thinker, but he was also a novelist, and he wrote what he called ghostly tales, horror stories. And my favorite of those is his collection of short stories, Ancestral Shadows, which is a collection of just wonderful stories. And he has an essay at the end of that at the end of that collection on why he writes ghostly tale, why he wrote ghostly tales. And he did so, he said, because he wanted to use ghostly tales in order to imaginatively illustrate the power of moral justice, you know, of truth, goodness, and beauty as they're applied in the world. And that these things are objective and they're also eternal. They're truly real. And being real, they transcend space, time, and circumstance. So could say a lot more about Kirk, but Kirk is an inspiring figure. He was, he and his wife, his widow, is of course still living. Mrs. Annette Kirk, and she's still a Macosta, still lives in the house. And the Kirk Center for Cultural Renewal is a very, very active and very vibrant center still there in Macosta. And you can go and visit and see the library and see the old toy factory and see where he did his work.
It's really interesting. I think the thing that's striking to me about Kirk, remind me, what was his big book on the sort of the history of conservatism? What was that called?
Well, he has two. His magnum opus was called The Conservative Mind.
The Conservative Mind, that's right.
Kirk Elliott. And then he had a follow-up work called The Roots of American Order that he wrote Conservative Mind in 1953, and then he wrote The Roots of American Order in 1974.
Right. Okay. So most, if you sort of read around the history of conservatism, The Conservative Mind will certainly be referenced as this sort of seminal book.
Yep.
I think it's interesting how much of a, you know, how you give a much more well-rounded sense of who he was and his interests, and they included literature and art, because I think it, for many sort of American readers in the 21st century, it's interesting just to think about how a lot of the authors that are still beloved come out of a, what you would call like a conservative imagination. And I think of the, you know, the sort of, I'd mentioned Orson Scott Card, I guess he would be part of this too, but really thinking of the British authors like G.K. Chesterton and C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, they would all fit in your, you know, sort of definition of conservative, and they build out these worlds that go way beyond the just talking about politics or anything like that. And but they have concepts and ways of thinking about the supernatural and what it means to be human that are ultimately rooted in some deep convictions, Christian convictions as well. I think it was, I'm going to butcher the quote, but G.K. Chesterton said something like, a detective novel only works in like a Christian worldview or something like that, because of the assumptions you're making about truth and about, you know, sort of justice and things like that.
Yes.
And so you can think of even certain genres that we just take for granted in American culture come out of these much deeper commitments that I don't think most of us, you know, contemplate at a given time. But anyway, Russell Kirk seems to me to be someone who was very influential in shaping a certain, you could say, conservative worldview that did include politics, but also had all these other perspectives or interests that weren't explicitly political.
Right. Exactly.
Okay, so talk to us about one more person, and this is sort of one of the more, most people will have passing familiarity with Burke and Kirk. These are sort of the big names, but Peter Viereck comes up again and again in your book, and probably less well known as to most of us. Who was Peter Viereck, and why is he an important figure for the way you're thinking about conservatism?
I was drawn to Peter Viereck because he is a neglected conservative. He was so influential, so such a powerful conservative voice in the post-war world when, you know, post-war conservatism is really coming to the fore, particularly with Russell Kirk and with William F. Buckley, who founded National Review in 1955, I believe. Viereck was right there in that same group of what was then called the New Right. In fact, I have an article sitting right here on my desk that I printed up. He wrote this article for the Atlantic Monthly entitled, But I'm a Conservative, and it appeared in 1940, so before the war started, and he was just a young man. I think he was, I can't remember if he was an undergraduate or if he was just starting out as graduate, but he was a young man at that point. He's in his early 20s, and he wrote this piece for the Atlantic Monthly entitled, But I'm a Conservative. So I was initially drawn to Viereck because of that. I was also drawn to Viereck because Viereck was a historian. He taught at Mount Holyoke College for 50 years. Yeah. 50 years. Wow. Amazing, amazing commitment that he had to his students and to that institution. Just amazing. He was born in 1916. He died in 2006. Mm. So he died fairly recently, much more recently to us than some others. And one of the things I loved about Viereck and love about him was that not only was he a great, you know, philosopher in terms of, you know, conservative thought, a historian. He studied the history of Russia and Central Europe. But he was also a poet. He won the Pulitzer Prize for poetry in 1949. Mm. And being a poet meant that his prose work is so engaging. And he is such a fine writer. And if I may, can I read you his definition of conservatism?
Please.
He said, "The conservative principles par excellence are proportion and measure, self-expression through self-restraint, preservation through reform, humanism and classical balance, a fruitful nostalgia for the permanent beneath the flux, and a fruitful obsession for unbroken historical continuity. These principles together create liberty, a liberty built not on the quicksand of adolescent defiance, but on the bedrock of ethics and law." And I love when he says, "a fruitful nostalgia for the permanent beneath the flux." And again, that's that emphasis on, we recognize that change is part of the world. So we call it the flux, but change is channeled. Change is managed by the permanent things. Mm-hmm. And we get the permanent things through from tradition, from religion, from authority. One of the things he said was, it is so emblematic of his wit and his such a good writer. In critiquing Rousseau's Social Contract, you know, of course, Rousseau begins with that very famous statement that man is born free and everywhere he's in chains. Mm-hmm. And Viereck responds by saying, "in chains, and so he ought to be." And what he means by that is that, you know, chains, the chains that Rousseau talks about are social custom, tradition, and authority. Mm-hmm. And Viereck had a realistic view of human nature. Human nature is not basically good. Human nature is basically flawed, fallen, sinful, reaches for power. So authority and tradition and order and just law, these things are our guardrails that keep us from careening off a cliff. Mm. So,
yeah, and I think another way to think of that chains quote is, I remember Yuval Levin, who's maybe a contemporary conservative writer. Right. He has a book from a few years ago on institutions and right. defending the role of institutions in our society. And he has a great question that I ask myself continually all the time. And he says, you know, one of the most fundamental questions you can ask as a citizen of a country or of a community, a member of a community, is, given my location, sort of what should I do? Or how should I act? Mm. And there's always that first part is so helpful to me, the given my location or given my role, given my standing in this institution, given my where I am on the org chart in my how should I act based on that. And for some people, that would feel like you're chaining down or you're locking down someone into a certain role or a certain setting. But of course, we're in those settings all over the place in our society, whether it's in our family or in voluntary societies or at our job or elsewhere. I think raising that question and really saying it's not actually chains, these aren't actually things that burden us in some type of way where they're imprisoning us, right. but they are actually from where we act and from where we're called to act. And we're called to act thoughtfully from a location. So it's not just an individual in a vacuum and saying, what should I do now? It's given where I'm at, given my responsibilities, what should I do? So I always think of that Yuval Levin quote as a way to try to temper or really try to think wisely about how to speak out, how to exercise authority, when to stay quiet based on location, not just sort of in a vacuum.
I love it.
Yeah. Okay. Just a couple more things I want to touch on now that we've sort of touched on a few of the key figures. One of the things I wanted to sort of just hit home talking about your book, John, is this sense that there is a lot to conservatism that is missing when we usually talk about conservatism. Mm-hmm. And this is one last way to get at this. I want to just give you a quote from page 65 in your book and ask you to talk a little more about it. So this is on page 65. It's in the chapter on the conservative imagination. And you write, "Conservatives missed an opportunity to fight for the private life, to take the road less traveled, and to cultivate an imagination and an inner life that led to true freedom from the spirit of the age." Give us some context for that quote and help us think about how can a conservative imagination really inform the inner life that leads to a true freedom?
Yeah. The context for that is I was reflecting on Peter Viereck and his book, The Unadjusted Man in an Age of Overadjustment. And Viereck, I said something about Kirk's personality a minute ago. Viereck was also another really interesting personality. He was very strange. He was a very strange man, but in a good way, not in a bad way, in a really endearing way. A couple of quick things. This, again, sets the context. His life on campus, when he was first hired at Mount Holyoke, he forgot to request an office. So he taught there for 50 years and he never had an office on campus. He was always, always 15 to 20 minutes late to class for 75-minute classes. Always 15, 20 minutes late. When he would lecture, he would focus on a light fixture. He would never look at the students in the face. He never returned papers. He never gave any feedback. So you always found out how you did in this class when you got your report card. He could go for days, even weeks, after daylight savings time, living by the old clock, because he just didn't remember. He would run into things. He would run into a wall. He would run into signs because he was in deep thought. He enjoyed climbing trees on campus, and he would sit in the trees. And the students would walk by, and there's Professor Viereck in the tree. So he was a character. He was he wrote a book in 1956, I believe, called The Unadjusted Man in an Age of Overadjustment. And he had these three metaphors, these three geographic metaphors. One was an island, one was a peninsula, and one was the mainland. And in terms of our relationship to the culture, relationship to the broader culture, the maladjusted man, that is the man on the island, someone who rejects culture, who hates the culture, get off my lawn, a hermit, kind of like the character in Gran Torino.
All right.
Clint Eastwood yeah. movie. Yeah. He's the maladjusted man. Didn't like people. Didn't just want to be left alone. You don't want that. You're a misanthrope at that point. And the other extreme is to be on the mainland and to have your entire personality, your entire worldview defined by cultural fads and cultural values. And you don't want that either. Mm-hmm. What you want is to be like a peninsula. You want to be far enough removed from the culture that the culture doesn't shape who you are. But you also want to be informed enough about the culture that you can contribute to the goodness of society, to the good of society, that is. So conservatives, my statement there that you read, is about how conservatives have missed an opportunity to follow that advice about being unadjusted to the culture. Mm. Being a conservative, by definition, is to be unadjusted from the culture. Conservatism, in the way that I'm advocating, is always going to be the minority. We're always going to be the weird ones. Peter Viereck has another great line where he says, "Liberalism argues. Conservatism simply is." Conservatives live by concrete reality and aren't trying to build utopias in the sky. And so on the progressive left, you have a vision to create a perfect society informed by, you know, sort of progressive values or revolutionary Marxism or what have you. And on the counter-revolutionary or reactionary right, you have a different vision, but it's equally utopic. It's a different set of things that they want in their agenda list, but it's just as utopic. It's just as abstract. But what a conservative advocates for is what's real and what we have to work with now. In Federalist 65, Alexander Hamilton defends the Constitution by saying it's not perfect. It wasn't meant to be perfect. It wasn't designed to be perfect. And the Anti-Federalists are always going to be right when they critique it. It's going to be flawed. But what the project of the Anti-Federalists is not to say that the Constitution fails hither and thither. What their task is to say that the Constitution is evil and it's bad and they can't do that. And that's an eminently conservative perspective. It's easy to critique the real and the concrete because it's what we live with every day. It's very difficult to critique the utopian vision, either of the hard right or the hard left. It's easy to critique that which we have, and it's the conservatives' task to defend that which we have. That's unadjusted to the culture. And to be unadjusted to the culture, you have to be more than just political. You have to cultivate an imagination that is humanistic, but that's also centered around the transcendentals, the good, the true, the beautiful. It has to be centered around God. Conservatives believe in God. Conservatives believe in the transcendent. And our worldview is sort of anchored on those things that are eternal, the permanent things that don't change, God and his ways, submission to God and his ways. These are things that are very important in a society, in a family, in a nation, and in the world. And it's a joyful task. It's not a burden. It's an aspirational task. It's also a lot of fun. It takes a little bit of sacrifice at times, but it's also makes our lives worth living.
Well, you mentioned God there, and I want to end by talking about religious freedom and ask you just help us fit in the idea of religious freedom into your view of conservatism. Why is it so important? And ultimately, where do you hope the conversation with religious freedom, you know, it centers now and going forward?
Yeah. I think religious freedom, like conservatism, is a term that has lost some of its credibility over the last 20 or 25 years. And that's, I think, a tragedy. And I think it's also very foreboding and very ominous for our society. Alexis de Tocqueville makes the argument in Democracy in America that religion is necessary to freedom. Because freedom, he talks about freedom in terms of an ordered freedom, an ordered liberty. That for freedom to be real, it has to be marked off with limits. Freedom is not just the idea that we can do whatever we want. That's actually slavery. But a rightly ordered freedom is one that's rightly ordered by just law and by a right ethic. So in this conversation that we're having, we're following a particular ethic. We're following a particular virtuous order in this conversation. We're not interrupting each other. We're not threatening each other. We're not insulting one another. While those things may be very entertaining to an audience, we're not doing those things. We're not just acting however we want to act. You may find disagreement on things I say. I might find disagreement with things you say, but we're going to respect each other. And because that's sort of the conversation can't go anywhere if we don't have some of those sort of rules that are unspoken and yet that we're living by.
Right.
So those rules, they set the conditions for a conversation that can be valuable and that can contribute something. And freedom can be understood in the same way. In order to have just order, well, we have to have religion, because religion shows us what just order is. It defines what justice is. We have historically, the Christian faith has been the predominant faith tradition in America. It's not the only faith system that has been important in American history, but historically, and I think still today, Christianity is the predominant faith system. Christianity is a moral system. And Tocqueville also says that even though there's great religious diversity in America, everybody agrees on a Christian moral system. So religion gives us morality. It also gives us a realistic set of limitations that we have. The most obvious one being that our lives are limited. Our time on earth is limited. So because it's limited, we get out of our shell. We get out of our selfish interests. We have to think about other people, because we recognize that we're not going to live forever. And you know, our lives matter for that reason. So religious freedom is very important because religious freedom forms the basis for how we treat each other. Even if we're not religious, even if we don't subscribe to a particular religion or go to church or any of those things, first of all, we're free. The government doesn't have a jurisdiction over our conscience. And religious freedom sets the pattern for other freedoms, like freedom of speech, like freedom of assembly, like freedom to associate. Because religious freedom demands that we do all of those things. When you're a religious person, you associate, you speak freely, you often have a press of some sort, you have written communication. Those freedoms that are in the First Amendment, they're all grounded in the freedom of religion. So religious freedom is an important tradition, and the argument of the book overall is that conservatives are in the best position to defend that tradition, and it's a good tradition, and it's worthy of being defended, stewarded, and handed down to younger generations.
Hmm. Is there a particular way you hope conservatives talk about religious freedom? I can think of, just as one example, I know in arguments have been made in the past and in the present that particularly Christians who, as you mentioned, tend to have the majority, or at least tend to be seen as part of the majority culture, should be especially concerned about protecting the freedoms of minorities as a way to say this isn't just about majority rules. It's actually when it doesn't necessarily make sense from the majority that these religious freedoms should be protected. Yeah. I don't know if that's what you'd advocate or something else, but how do you think conservatives should be articulating the universal value of religious freedom?
I think it's a great question. Yeah. I ask students a lot this way. I say, how do you know when you're free? How do you know what freedom is? How do you know when you have freedom? And the answer to that question is, you know you have freedom when you're responsible for something. Because freedom and responsibility are always entailed in one another. So an example would be, let's say that you work at a Chick-fil-A or at a McDonald's or at a Starbucks or something. If you're an employee that's going to run the register, you know, you're not responsible for your fellow workers' behavior. They come in high, they come in late, they're stealing the money. I mean, that's going to be something that you're going to notice, you're not going to necessarily approve of, you're not going to like, and you might want to quit, but it's not your responsibility. That's the manager's responsibility. Thus, you don't have the freedom to write the handbook for the employees. You don't have the freedom to fire them. You don't have the freedom to reward them for good things that they do. You don't have the freedom, you don't have the responsibility, but the manager does. So the manager does have the freedom and the responsibility. So how do you know when you're free? When you're responsible for something. And with regard to religious freedom, we know that we're free when we have a responsibility to our fellows out there. So I'm a Christian, I'm a Protestant, I'm a Baptist. I know that I have religious freedom when I have a duty to my Catholic friends, my Jewish friends, my Muslim friends, and my non-practicing friends. I have a responsibility to protect and guard their religious freedom, their freedom to practice their faith the way that their convictions direct them. And also, I have a responsibility, and according to Scripture, to attempt to persuade them to the truth of the gospel. But if they reject that truth, I'm not responsible for that. I'm not responsible for their rejection of it. I'm responsible to try to persuade them, but if they aren't persuaded, then to respect that as well. So freedom always comes with responsibility. And that's also something that conservatives have always argued for. Moral responsibility is always going to be attended by freedom. That's how you know you have it.
I love that pairing of freedom and responsibility. Thanks, John, for the conversation. Again, the book is Religious Freedom, A Conservative Primer. And thank you for tuning in to the Upwards podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. And for more information about the Stephen and Laurel Brown Foundation, please visit slbf.org, where we have dozens of conversations just like this one on our studio page. Until next time, go in peace.